All right, good afternoon, everyone. It's close enough to 2 o'clock for me. So, very warm welcome. I declare this council meeting for the 14th of August open. Welcome to staff, members of the public. There are quite a few with us today. We have a number of presentations and the media. All right, we'll move straight on to the agenda. There are no apologies. There's no leave of absence. In attendance, we'll deal with that as the various groups come forward and introduce them at that point. Confirm the agenda as circulated and remind councillors about conflicts of interest and the need to identify those as agenda items come up. So we'll move straight to the public forum. And welcome Andrew and Shelley Sutherland, Jamie Prout and Jack Buzzell. Welcome, folks. And Jack and Shelley are going to present. Is that correct, Shelley? Yes? Yep. Yes, all four of you can come out and grab the seat on the spare seat on the end there. Yes. Now, so councillors are aware, some of this group presented in our public forum a couple of weeks ago, but they're here on a slightly different topic today, so it's not a repeat. And the two of them are going to present, so welcome. You're aware of the public forum rules with us 5 minutes, and then we'll have some points of clarification. So welcome. Shelley, I think we're in your hands.
Thank you, Stephen. Chairman, councillors, members of...
Can you speak up, Shelley, and speak into that microphone?
Yeah, please. How's that?
Thank you, that's wonderful.
Thank you. Chairman Woodhead, you were very appreciative of my presentation to the council recently on the scientific evidence and my subsequent plea to the council to join dozens of other bodies around the planet in declaring a climate emergency, and I thank you for that. I requested your time today to raise another matter of concern to me. However, I have just learned that the council is debating the decision as to whether to declare a climate emergency per today's agenda. This is the most crucial of issues. In response to the decline to my request to add anything to the information in my initial presentation, and in order to preserve the focus on the climate emergency debate, I choose today not to raise another issue, so I don't want to speak on the reason I asked for this time. However, rather than simply cancel this time and be a no-show, I took the decision to appear in person to declare you free to consider this climate crisis. I propose that the balance of time set aside for me today be used as a further 4 minutes or maybe 3.5 in silence to allow the council additional time for the deliberation on this most urgent matters on our planet. Councillors and all those present, thank you for your time. And if you choose, the minute silence can start now or you can use it at the end.
We'll keep moving at this point, but thank you for making the point. And all right, Jamie, I think you're going to...
Kia ora, can you hear me well enough like that?
Yes, thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks for the time today. And my name's Jamie, and I'm a PhD student here at Otago. And I'd like to present on how the Otago Regional Council, representing the people of Otago, need to declare a climate and ecological emergency today. And... a climate ecological emergency is appreciating the science that shows the planet is warming fast and it affects many of these ecosystems. It's appreciating the science that shows the mass extinctions that are occurring. For example, over 1 million species being currently threatened with extinction, and we don't want humans to be in that category, surely. In the local government's leaders' climate change declaration in 2017 that a few of you were at, the mayors and chairs of Aotearoa New Zealand agreed to, and I quote, acknowledge the importance and urgent need to address climate change for the benefit of current and future generations. Give our support to the New Zealand government for developing and implementing in collaborations with councils, communities and businesses, an ambitious transition plan towards low carbon and resilient New Zealand. Encourage government to be more ambitious for climate change mitigation. Outline key commitments of our councils taking and in responding with the opportunities and risks posed by climate change, and recommend important guiding principles for responding to climate change. So I'd just like to quote some of the guiding principles, and they are, to summarise, precaution, there is clear and compelling evidence for the need to act now on climate change. Acting now will reduce the future risks and the costs associated with climate change. Stewardship, organisations have a duty to safeguard and to safeguard the life-supporting capacity of our environment. Equity and justice, it's fundamental human right to inherit and a habitable planet and live in a just society. The most vulnerable in our community are often the disproportionately affected by change and natural hazards. Anticipation, which is thinking and acting long-term. Long-term thinking, policies, and actions that are needed to ensure the reasonably foreseeable needs of the current and future generations are met. Understanding, sound knowledge is the basis for information decision and participatory democracy. Cooperation and resilience. So with these in mind, that the mayors and the chairpersons of the city councils and regional councils, including our chairperson today, had signed, I asked the ORC to take action on that. We're a small nation that's successfully taken stand against nuclear and showed incredible compassion and action after the Otatahi Christchurch shootings. And I ask that we treat the climate and ecological crisis with the same level of action. This climate emergency declaration has already been done, already been declared by the Dunedin City Council, Auckland, Wellington, Nelson, Hawke's Bay, even the Pope, the United Kingdom, and many other places abroad. I encourage you to hear the voices of the people you represent, the Indigenous people, and of our and mine future children. I encourage you to take seriously the local government's leadership climate change declaration that you signed, to follow the United Nations IPCC 1.5 report, and to show compassion for your people, to acknowledge and listen to that solid science, and to declare a climate and ecological emergency. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. Are there any points of clarification from councillors? Councillor Lawton.
Thank you for coming along today and reminding us of the responsibilities we've already said we would take on board. What do you talk about responsibility from our behalf? What would that actually look like for you? What do you expect that will happen out of our declaration? What are you on this make it? What does it look like?
The first step in resolving almost any problem philosophically is to appreciate the problem that we have to address. So declaring the climate and ecological emergency is that first step that then helps people see that as an accountability measure. So in the future, we can continue to look at new reforms and things happening and say, well, how does this hold up against the climate and ecological emergency that's actually there? It encourages people to take action. And most importantly, it represents the ideologies of those who the ORC are representing, so us as civilians. Yeah.
Can I add something? Thank you. I think that was a really good response. For me, it would be a range of things, of little things to big things. So the government has legislated about plastic bags, and there's been a whole lot of talk in the media about making electric cars more accessible for everyone. I mean, apart from the cost, which can be prohibitive for a lot of people. So from the regional council, what I would expect to see is a range of things, from whatever is your version of the plastic bags to having communication with your staff around, hey, look, we're engaged about climate change now. This is what it's going to mean for you. We're going to start buying electric cars. We're going to start doing these things to change our planet in as small or big ways as we can. It might be talking about the sea level rising. You monitor water levels as part of your remit, don't you? So it might be thinking about things like that are going to change that your staff and then your clients, which I guess we are, I don't know how you think of us, but we're stakeholders, aren't we, can make changes along with you to ward off the 2030 crisis that I... So I'm talking about climate emergency again, I apologise. I was answering his question. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, guys. You, I imagine, Shelley, might have been involved with the board that's sitting on the vehicle outside Stafford Street. Have you seen that?
I heart the City Council Board.
Is that the one with the spelling mistake on it?
Mm. Yeah. So just have a look at the spelling of emergency. Just a wee joke.
So you did look at it?
Oh, it's right outside my office window. I've got a photo.
Thank you.
But, yeah, couldn't miss it, but there's a wee typo in emergency.
Are you really distracted by the typo?
No.
Good.
But I just noted it. But,
that's great. Anyway. We love hearing that you've actually read it. It's a wee trick.
I think
you're
acting
right.
On it,
yeah,
is
we'll
probably
call that,
the key.
Call that one all. Yeah.
It should be.
Righto. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. All right, we'll move on to presentations, and we do have two presentations today, and with their permission, and hopefully councillors will be comfortable, I've changed the order. So we'll start with the Yellow Eye Penguin Trust annual report. And so we have with us Dr. Trudy Webster, Sue Murray and Eric Shelton. Come up, folks. And Trudy, I think, is going to work through a presentation. Is there a PowerPoint presentation,
yes,
Liz? Yes, just bringing up the PowerPoint. So welcome. And we, as councillors will be aware, and staff, I'm sure, we do support the work of the Yellow Eye Penguin Trust and look forward to an annual update. And understand there's been some challenges in the last 12 months, and so look forward to hearing the presentation, and perhaps we might be able to have a bit of questions after, follow up with the questions from councillors.
Yeah, for sure. I'd just like to start by thanking the Regional Council for funding my position. You've funded it now since 2016, so I'm very grateful for that. So I'm just going to give you a rundown of sort of our season to date, which I apologise is a bit of a depressing one.
Trudy, just pull that microphone as close as you can.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And encourage you to speak up, please. Yes, that'll be fine. Just, yep,
cool.
And speak up.
No problem.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm just going to give you a bit of an overview to start with about our season, talk about some key work that we undertook in 2018-19. And then a bit about a strategy and an action plan for Hoiho that we've been working on, and then some future plans. So 2018-19 has been a pretty appalling season for us. Hoiho are unfortunately an indicator of what's been going on in the environment, and unfortunately they're just not adapting quick enough to the change. So there's been an ongoing decline. Our monitoring with DOC and other site managers has shown that there are now only 227 breeding pairs on the mainland. So the graph at the bottom there, the blue line, shows the mainland population. There was a previous low dip in 1989-90, and that was after a mass mortality event, but they bounced back after that, and now we've just got an ongoing sort of declining trend, which is the same at Stewart Island, Rakiura, that yellow, the red line, and Whenuaho, Codfish Island. So we had really poor natural fledging success this year. In fact, only one of our 31 nests that we manage in the Catlins fledged a wild chick. We had a record number of birds that had to come into rehab, so that was over 430, and when you consider that there are only 227 breeding pairs on the mainland, that's quite a few birds. And 44% of our breeders had to be brought in to be supplementary fed. So basically the season was characterised by a series of adverse events. You guys might remember this one. This is from your data from your website. So the graph there is showing the Clutha River flow. So in the middle of November, we had these two big events where we went up to about 1,600 and 2,700 cumex, so big heavy rain event, and unfortunately for us this coincided with chick hatch, so chicks very vulnerable on the nests when they're only small, and we had several nests that were inundated with water. So the flooding also resulted in some changes to the marine environment. So this is just an image taken from the MODIS satellite, which shows the plume of water coming out from the Clutha and from the Tyree further north. And this water sort of extended out to about 30 k's offshore. It kind of disappears there under the cloud, which is, you know, why we got our name. But this really crosses over with the foraging range of penguins. So they forage out to about 25 kilometres offshore, typically during this nesting period. So then immediately after the flooding event, we had our first starvation event. We had parents that were failing to feed their chicks sufficiently, so resulting in low weight chicks. We had some fairly atypical parental foraging, so either birds were both out, both at the nest when one of them should have been out foraging, or one parent was out for multiple days. Both of those things result in low chick weights. We had parents leaving chicks alone at the nest a lot earlier than they normally do, so that's the early postguard. So this happened at 4 or 5 weeks instead of 6 or 7. Just means that the chicks are more vulnerable when they're left when they're smaller. There was a glimmer of hope where birds started to gain weight just before Christmas, and then we had a secondary event, and I'm not sure what caused that. But chicks started to lose weight again after Christmas, and the problems then continued into molt. And we had birds trying to go into molt at sort of 4.5 kilos when they should be up at 7.5. And so the result is the sort of bird on the right there with, you can see its breastbone visible. So this is the massive effort to pick up birds. I mean, this is not an ideal situation. It's not really what we want to be doing, but it doesn't seem that there's any other option at the moment. So a total of 430 birds were uplifted across the mainland this season. 324 of those came to Dunedin, so that was mainly through Penguin Place and the Wildlife Hospital. And of those, 213 were adults and 80 plus chicks and a few juveniles as well. And you can see from those graphs, the main reason for them coming in was the fact that they were underweight. Some of them did have injuries as well, but the vast majority were underweight. So unfortunately, we had quite a number of deaths this year as well. We had 106 birds die, and the majority of these, again, were linked to starvation. So either straight-out starvation, or it was poor body condition, which then resulted in lung infections or malaria or bacterial septicemia. So 63 of those birds were adults, so that's a significant proportion of our adults, and at least 10 we know are breeding females, so actively breeding females. So that's going to have knock-on consequences for us next season. Another issue, sorry, it doesn't get any more rosy. Another issue this year was the unexplained mortality. So this is when we have seemingly healthy birds that just keel over and die. The thought is that it's potentially a toxin-related thing, that all the symptoms get found at post-mortem. So all the birds end up with this massive red blood cell destruction, which is particularly evident in the spleen and the liver and the lungs. And whilst there are only a small number of birds this year, we only had 7 deaths due to this, we seem to have these events fairly, you know, each year a few birds die and then we have these big events. So in 2012-13, we had our last big event, which was 67 birds died. And then the event that I talked about before was in 89-90, where we lost 150 birds to this. And we still have no idea what causes it. So avian malaria has also emerged as an issue over the last couple of years. And Dunedin's not really the first place that I think you would associate with malaria, but it seems that times are changing. So that top photograph there, I'm not sure if you can see, but there's about 50 mosquitoes on that one bird's flipper. So pretty surprising in Dunedin, I thought. So we actually lost 20 birds to avian malaria this year, and last season we lost 30 birds. And so really it's just a new and emerging threat. All right. So some of our key work in 2018-19, so a lot of it, because of all these events, a lot of our work has involved increased effort. So we actually took on an extra staff member, more time in the field, just being more flexible with our working hours, just in order for us to be able to pick up these birds and work out who needs to be brought in. So we also, more field support and data analysis has been required just to help support and ensure that we can make quick decisions in the field. I convened a workshop with some vets, given the recent malaria incidents, which from them we developed a series of disease response protocols. So a malaria protocol, which talked about treatment and control and monitoring. Also a response plan for unexplained mortality and diphtheria treatment as well, which is another thing that chicks face. And so I was also involved during the season in managing those different events. So there are also some research collaborations that we've been working on. We conducted a multi-beam echosounder trial, which was basically using the university boat, going out to sea off Arawana and off Boulder Beach just to see if we could look at foraging habitat to see if that was an effective way of monitoring that, and it seemed to work pretty well. We also had a student that was doing some drone surveys. He basically did some high-resolution imagery a year apart from each other and looked at changes at our Victory Beach Reserve. So this was really to detect places that were sensitive to erosion or sea level rise. We've also been involved in some remote sensing to see if the Portobello long-term data set is valid for a wider area, and also working with some researchers at Microbiology who are analysing cloacal and oral swabs for fungi and viruses and bacteria. So to look at the kind of diseases that the birds are facing. And we're also involved in some seabird surveys off the Otago Canyons, just off the coast here, to look at how oceanography and the habitat influence distribution. So some key work from a sort of a strategy and liaison point of view, aside from the Hoiho technical group work, which I'm going to talk about next. I've also been working a lot with fishers and industry. We've set up a fisheries information group, and this is really to understand some of the risks to Hoiho and discussing set net mitigation options and actually working out operational plans for different vessels. I also do a bit of work with the Conservation Services Programme and the Aquatic Environment Working Group that's through MPI and DOC. So we've been looking at the indirect effects of fishing and tracking birds at sea. Also done some work with the Regional Council, the oil response plan. So we gave some review and feedback for that. Also met with the biodiversity team here to link up with them. And also the New Zealand Biodiversity Strategy, so that's going through, that's being talked about at the moment, so there's actually another workshop coming up at the start of September for that. And there's been several presentations as well to a variety of groups, from vets to fishers to marine science at the bottom there. So last weekend, the Minister for Conservation launched the draft strategy and action plan that we've been working on. So both of these documents are open for feedback at the moment, and actually we've left some of those documents with you. So we've left the strategy and the action plans available online if you'd like it as well. So basically, this is a partnership between four different organisations that have got a key stake in Hoi Ho Conservation, so we're working very closely with the Department of Conservation, Fisheries New Zealand, and Te Runanga o Naitahu as well. And so we've got a governance group and a technical group that's made up of those four different organisations, obviously working alongside other members of the community as well. And so we've developed this three-tier programme. So it's an integrated programme really aimed at supporting the health and well-being of Hoi Ho in the marine and the technical, the marine and the terrestrial environments. So we've got a high-level strategy at the top. This is providing direction and guidance and sets out our strategic priorities. We've then got a five-year action plan that sits in the middle there, which helps us to plan and prioritise our work. And at the bottom there are the tikanga, so the detailed guidance. This is for managing particular things for specific issues like disease. So the strategy really sets out 20 sort of priorities to address the gap between where we are now and where we'd actually like to be. And it's divided into five main themes. So these are the themes that are up on the slide. So we've got health and monitoring. I've talked a lot about the disease and the monitoring that's required around that. There's also a section on marine threats, so looking at fisheries, habitat and ecosystem and pollution. And then there's a section on human disturbance, so managing tourism and managing threat from dogs. Terrestrial habitat, which is all about land-based predators and providing habitat. And then we've got a section on working together, which is really prioritising our resourcing and ensuring collaboration and coordination of work. So these themes and priorities are carried through the strategy and then the action plan. So each strategic priority is supported by a number of actions, and these are set over a five-year rolling timeline, and each action sort of identifies the partners and groups that are involved in those actions. All right, so I'll just talk really quickly some immediate work that will be taking place. Obviously, given the events of last year and the year before, we've increased our resources, so we have another staff member that's working down in the Catlins and another 0.6 of a position that's working up here. And this is really to ensure that we can deliver this increased effort that's required for monitoring Hoi Ho effectively. We need to mosquito-proof rehab and soft-release pens, and this is because of the malaria issue. There's going to be a Campbell Island expedition in November. We really know very little about what's going on in the subantarctic, so we're trying to rectify that. And we've got a big international conference, that's the IPC10, so the International Penguin Conference next week, where I'll be running a workshop on disease and doing another presentation. We've secured some more work, some more funding for the multi-beam surveys to look at habitat at sea, and we've also secured funding for a PhD student to investigate malaria further and the implications for Hoi Ho. Yeah, and I'd just like to say that we work with a huge range of different organisations, so I'd like to take the opportunity to thank those on the slide here, and obviously to the Regional Council again for funding my position. So thanks for listening.
Thank you, Trudy. And yes, we have been aware of the work that's gone in the last 12 months. Unfortunately, yep. It's not a really positive story.
No,
it's been
it isn't,
a fair old,
sorry.
Fair old battle. So yep. Thank you for that yep. comprehensive report. So yes, and councillors, we do have a copy of the strategy here we'll hand out cool. later. And we've got a couple of spare copies there for staff too. So questions. Councillor Scott.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for the presentation. As I understand it, there's a real possibility that the yellow-eyed penguin might cease to exist on the mainland. I think there was various documentation coming out about yep. that. What's the underlying theme? Like you've talked about, I think you talked about flooding in the Clutha and sedimentation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you actually said it. Then you talked about disease, mosquitoes. So, I mean, what's the cause of all? Is there a common cause or causes in terms of driving this?
Yeah, so obviously it's the starvation events that are that are the reason for the disease. What's causing the starvation is less clear. So it's probably a combination of events. We know that sea surface temperature, for example, does have an implication. So Thomas Matern did some modelling that suggested about a third of the variation that you were seeing was a result of sea surface temperature increases. So birds do worse in hotter temperatures. That's obviously not a direct link. It's likely something to do with changes in the food chain. So probably fisheries have some impact. Sedimentation might have some impact, pollution potentially. But I think the thing is that all of those things together, plus all the things that they're facing on land, have just sort of tipped them over the edge. And so by addressing any of those, you know, we just reduce the impact on them. And yeah, so yeah, multiple things, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Hope.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. You must feel absolutely devastated, do you? Because it's just, I was thinking about, as you said, and you said, well, it gets worse. And I thought, surely it couldn't get worse.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that. And then I was looking at, and please don't take this the wrong way, but say you've got mainland brand up there. Is that the cheese?
Yep.
And we all buy the mainland brand, and we see the wee hoi-ho piece on there.
Yep.
Could we somehow do better? Where we're explaining that there is actually that the hoi-ho needs us more than ever. I'm lucky and I'm privileged and I sit here with all these other people and we get to hear about what's happening and it's really awful. Yep. And I am so devastated for you because I've heard you, I think, 2 or 3 years ago and your work is always extraordinary and we've funded you and we're delighted to have you all here. But for the public as well, we've got the ODT here today and all sorts of people who will critically see that there's a real fundamental, a lot of problems coming together that's not helping this lovely little creature.
Yep.
Is there a message that you have got that you could perhaps play? I mean, is more money what you need? I mean, I appreciate you saying that we fund your position.
Yeah, you do fund the position.
What else do you need?
Money obviously is part of it, but, you know, we've obviously had to increase our, all the positions. And I think it's worth remembering that whilst it is a depressing story, without having gone out there and pulled in all these birds this year, probably would have another 400 birds that died.
Yes.
So, you know, it is a negative story, but we are doing something about it. And now we need to try and look a bit more at the long-term changes that we can make. And, you know, we obviously do that on some of our reserves. We do planting, we do...
And if you look back in years past, has this happened before with the penguins? If you were to look way back when other people have been doing this research like you have, is there any correlations that you can make? Say, well, you know, like 30 years ago they had this problem and they found out from the Balclutha vets because they saw da-da-da-da-da.
I mean, there have been big events in the past. So there have been these big mass mortality events and there was one in 89, 90 and one in 2012. There's not been this kind of just continuous decline that we're seeing now, and there have been starvation events in the past. So I think there was a chick starvation event in 2014. I think it's just everything at the moment.
Compounded.
And they're just kind of in free fall, really. Yeah.
Councillor Brown?
So there's other penguin species. Are they suffering the same fate? Mm. Blue penguins?
Blue penguins don't appear. So when we had that first starvation event, blue penguins were definitely affected, which kind of suggests that it was something to do maybe with the visibility or that was having some knock-on consequences for food. But then blue penguins are good because they can breed multiple times a year, so they've got a much better chance, so they can breed a lot quicker and get their numbers up, so they're not doing nearly as badly as these guys that just breed once a year, have a maximum of 2 chicks, and if they fail, that's it. So, yeah, that's really their problem.
Councillor Bell, did you have a question?
No. I think it was a numbers game.
All right. Thank you. And Sue, Eric and Trudy, and appreciate your work. All we can do really is wish you all the best for the next year, but there's certainly some challenges.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
So thank you for taking some time today and
thank
you for your presentation, Trudy.
Thank you very much.
All right, we do have another presentation, and we have representatives from Queensland Lakes District Council and Tonka Taylor with us. So Erin Morgan from QLDC Maintenance and Operations Manager, Laura Gledhill, Contracts Manager, and Simone Eldridge from Tonka Taylor. But before we ask them to update us on the landfill, and the challenges they've got there. We, ORC and QLDC have been working for quite some time on these issues. They've been somewhat public recently, but we're going to... Peter Winder, you just want to give us an introduction.
A very brief introduction.
Give us some brief context, please. Yeah, thank you.
At the last Regulatory Committee meeting, there was some discussion around the compliance track record for the Victoria Flats landfill,
yep.
And we noted that a review of consent conditions was underway and so on. Since then, the review of consent conditions has been completed and all signed off, and QLDC are a long way down the track of what needs to happen to address odour and performance of the landfill. The review of consent conditions means that the consent now complies with the National Environmental Standard for Air Quality that goes back to 2004, and there's a body of work that needs to happen now with the landfill.
Yes.
And we thought that this was a good opportunity to make sure you were briefed as to where things were at and what comes next before the work commences. And there'll be, as we go, there's an obvious reason as to why being warned beforehand is a wise thing to do.
Yep.
So with that by way of introduction, here's the team from QLDC.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us here today. Everybody here okay?
Yep. Yes. That's
okay.
Brilliant.
Great. So I guess first thing to start off with is just don't want to make the silly assumption that everybody actually knows where the Victoria Flats landfill is located. So this one's partway between Queenstown and Cromwell, the area known as Victoria Flats. And the Victoria Flats landfill takes the refuse both from the Queenstown Lakes District as well as the Central Otago District. It's an area where Queenstown Lakes owns the land. We hold the consents that are relevant to the landfill, and then the landfill's actually been constructed and is owned and operated by Scope Resources under a contract to Queenstown Lakes and Central Otago for a period of 30 years, and we're about two-thirds of the way through that contract at the moment. You may recall that... Sorry, that's the consents that we hold for those ones at the moment... You may recall that a few years ago we had a little bit of an increase in the number of odour complaints that were happening out at the landfill, largely around the winter time in particular. We did quite a bit of work with Scope sort of throughout 2015 and with the ORC to try to identify why we were seeing an increase in the odour at that time. And what we found was that the way that we were taking biosolids from the treatment plants, for the wastewater treatment plants for both Central Otago and Queenstown Lakes, and treating it in a way before we put it in the landfill to try and keep it inert once it was in the landfill, was causing odour issues during the time that it was actually brought onto site being treated before it actually went into the landfill. So during that time, we got... We had the Gibson community, which are the closest community to the landfill, quite a few meetings that we had with that community, and they had some concerns around the landfill. And at that time, we started to work a little bit more closely, I think we could say, with both the ORC as well as QLDC take some additional steps around the landfill. One of the things that we introduced at that time was we've got a staff member from QLDC who does daily monitoring of the odour both morning and night at the landfill, well, around the landfill at several different points, so that we could start to build a picture of whether or not we were seeing different trends over time. The other thing that we did was we agreed with Scope to stop taking those biosolid loads from the two districts to the landfill and instead started taking those to Winton, where they were better equipped to deal with that with their gas capture system at their landfill. We then continued to work closely with the ORC, and we were given the early heads up about 18 months ago that the intention was for those consent conditions to change, and that would obviously bring us to a point where we'd need to install a gas capture system on the landfill at Victoria Flats. So we've worked, we were sort of able then, therefore, to be about 12 months ahead of the process on that one. So we've now, the consent's just come through in the last 2 weeks, or a couple of weeks, and we're actually already about a year ahead of that. So we've got the gas capture system designed and agreed. It's something that's going to be funded by Scope, as they still own the landfill, so they will be funding and building that. But QLDC brought in Simon from Tonkin and Taylor to start being involved in the governance groups for the landfill and very closely involved in the design of that gas capture system to make sure that that was something that was going to be effective for, I guess, both districts, given, I guess, the complexities around every landfill being different and every one of these systems needing to be slightly different for each different landfill. So we're now at the process where we're starting to drill some wells there and start actually installing pipes towards the end of this calendar year to start actually building that gas capture system. That will be completed by the end of next year, those works. But I guess what we were giving the guys a heads up on the other day is that actually putting the pipe works in to facilitate the gas capture means that we actually have to remove some of the capping off the landfill to enable that to happen. What we're expecting is that we are going to have some increase in odour to be experienced by the communities during that time. So what we're doing is Scope will be engaging with the Gibston community as those likely to be most affected, to bring them actually onto the landfill site, talk through exactly what's going to be happening in that installation phase and what they can expect. There'll also be media put out for both the QLDC as well as Central Otago, given there's quite a few Central Otago residents that pass that landfill on their commute on the state highway each morning. So we want to make sure that everybody knows that this is an actual project piece of work that's going to have a limited, you know, time frame of odour, and the reasons that it's being done is actually, you know, one of these steps that we're taking to improve the odour issues that we do experience through landfills. So I wanted, I guess, to come and give you guys a briefing on that and an opportunity to, I guess, open the floor to whether you had any questions on that.
Thank you.
More than happy to talk. This is what the gas capture system will be looking like, but for anybody who is a bit of a tech head and wants to ask some questions on that of Simon, feel free.
What do you want to do?
Councillor Hope.
Hello. Can I ask you about that capping system? So am I right? Forgive my ignorance, but I have been listening.
Oh.
So you capture it, right? You capture the odour, and then where does it go?
I'll let Simone answer these, so she'll do it far more eloquently than I will.
So the landfill gas will be... Sorry, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. Brilliant. The landfill gas will be captured and conveyed to a landfill gas flare, where it will be ignited and to convert it into carbon dioxide. The methane is destroyed in the flare, and the odour generally comes from... It does come a bit from the methane, but it also comes from volatile organics that are in the landfill gas, and they are also destroyed in the flare, which is why it's under the NES. It has to be at a temperature of 750 degrees Celsius.
Now, is that on-site, or does that flare get taken away?
No, so the flare is actually... it's down the bottom. That figure actually just... Sorry, my eyes are...
The next one.
There's one, the next one. Oh, so that, right. So it'll look a little bit like that. So that's a standard enclosed landfill gas flare. And then the environment standard also requires a backup flare, which is the photograph in the middle, which is in case the permanent flare is not operating. So it's got a fail-safe.
Like a one duty, one standby sort of thing.
Correct.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's right.
Councillor Laws?
yes, it's not just the Gibston Valley community. In fact, in some ways, I wouldn't say they're the least affected, but it's all traffic that goes through that area, and it's a massive amount of traffic, national and international. And it also comes down the comes down the gorge. So it doesn't just hover into that Gibston area, it comes right back up to 5 kilometres on occasion. I'm glad that you're here, but the reason you're here is because it went public and that there was concern. I'm trying to work out how things got so bad. In 2015, you've got a problem, you know you've got a problem, and you do something about it. But in 2019, it becomes a dreadful problem as well. And it sours the trips for folks going through that particular locale day after day after day. And yet you say you have somebody monitoring it every day, is that correct?
That's right.
So why wasn't that reported in the system? You see, when we sent Mr. Winders to investigate, he didn't know that that was the source of the odour. Was there any liaison between you and EORC as to the odour that was emanating from the landfill?
So over the past, since that 2015 period, we've met with, not with Peter, but with officers of the ORC. I understand at various times we've also provided that reporting across to the ORC that we do as well. I think the complexity of it is, though, is that we do that at 2 points during the day, and odour isn't necessarily something that stays static. So you could have a period of odour that comes on for a half an hour during a period of day and then disappears and you don't smell it again for the day. So it is a little bit hit and miss as to whether or not we capture on that day that there was any odour generated throughout that period. In terms of what's been happening in 2019, I think what we believe is that it's not significantly different amount of odour that's being experienced, but what's actually changed is the time of day that it's been happening. So we always do get a little bit more odour that happens over the winter period, and it is particularly the case historically in the early mornings on when there's an inversion layer that sits over the valley, and essentially we get some odour trapped in pockets sitting under the inversion layer. What's happened in 2019 is that for some unknown reason, we seem to be getting that inversion layer more in the afternoons than in the morning, and that's created, I guess, a different perception and a different experience for people passing the landfill.
Now, you say that it's ironic in actual fact, because here we are about to talk about climate change and here you are burning methane. Is that your answer? A number of other landfills in New Zealand are converting methane into electricity. Why isn't that an option here?
Again, I'll defer to Simone on that one.
Okay.
So the destruction of the methane actually reduces the global warming potential by 23 times. So there's a benefit in, rather than the methane emitting to atmosphere, it's being destroyed into carbon dioxide. We have looked at the viability of electricity generation for the site. But because the site's only taking in about 40 to 50,000 tonnes per annum, it's actually not economically viable within our current electricity structure for you to be able to generate electricity at that level. You generally need 100,000 to 200,000 tonnes per annum, which would be counterintuitive to waste minimisation. So we're in a situation where this site is just not accepting enough waste for it to be viable.
You're going to be laying pipeworks, you say, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. You're talking about the end of 2020.
Sorry, the initial works that we'll be doing where we're expecting that to change, there may be a little bit, probably about 3 to 4 weeks down the track, but we're expecting that to be fairly minimal. The main will be around November this year.
So it's going to get really bad in November?
Wouldn't say really bad, but it's possible that people will be experiencing a higher level. And if I just go another slide forward, you'll see that one of the other things that we need to do as part of the process is to actually amend the slopes on the side of the landfill to be at a better gradient to more efficiently run the gas capture system. So that's also part of the works that we're going to need to do there that will involve changing around the capping and essentially disturbing the site, which may create some odour.
I've travelled repeatedly through that particular area for the last 3 months. I think I've counted it up. I've made 32 trips in that time. On 29, the odour was discernible in the car. so actually in the car. And on some days it was just appalling.
You should open your windows.
No, you can't open the window, you silly boy.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things on that. Obviously, we are regulated by ORC, and there is things around to what extent the odour is acceptable outside of the boundary of the landfill. The other thing is that we need to be a little bit careful of too, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the case, but I'm a resident of Gibston Valley, so I actually live in the closest subdivision to the end of the bluff that Victoria Flats is at. And so I tend to drive home in the evening with my nose reasonably well attuned to see whether or not I can smell anything before I turn off to my place. And one of the other things that we also have a bit of a challenge there is that the vineyard work that happens throughout Gibston Valley also has fertilisers and things like that applied at various different times as well. So there's been some days as well when, I'm not saying this is what you've smelt, but I think there are some members of the public as well who are saying that they've driven through, you know, the other end of Gibston Valley quite a long way away from the landfill and smelt odour. But what we need to be quite careful of is that, you know, we are distinguishing what is the landfill odour and landfill gas odour versus what I guess is more of a blood and bone type fertiliser product which is put on the vineyards at certain times of year as well. So one of the things Simon's been working with us on is how to distinguish different types of odour from the landfill and therefore what the underlying causes of those might be and what we can do differently to reduce those.
I think we all know what methane smells like. Finally, there are a number of mitigation techniques around odour. They're used, I used them once when I was mayor, we used them in our own area. They are employed at making sure that the odour doesn't stretch beyond the area in which you're doing the works. I don't hear any odour mitigation works being planned here for when you're doing your repairs.
Yeah, so basically there's a, and these guys can probably talk to this better than I can, but there are deodorising methods that are used at the landfill, and we use those already. We'll obviously be increasing the use of that during that time.
So you've got the sprays?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if you know specifically what the product is.
Yes, we use Super Spice.
And you've got, they're placed up adjacent, and you just simply are spraying them repeatedly during that time, are you?
No, these are the ones that an operator actually walks round and sprays out.
Oh, no, that's not a system at all. Okay.
Councillor Dean?
That explains it.
You may be required by way of a consent condition to have a community or neighbourhood liaison group. You may not be as well required to do that. If you aren't, would you consider voluntarily establishing a neighbourhood liaison group focused, obviously, the Gibston Valley community and any other neighbour that has an interest, with an independent chair that met as required to ensure that that community is informed to, you know, make them aware of such establishment of the gas collection where the cap's coming off, greater odour over the next month or two, neighbours, whatever. Would you consider that? But the first question, I suppose, are you required by way of a consent condition to establish that sort of group?
No, not required by a consent condition, and I guess we're not planning to go quite that far, but what we have done in, you know, for quite a number of years is it's always been essentially an open door policy to, and again, we've been focused primarily on the Gibston community, that we're essentially quite happy to come as they hold monthly meetings out there. We're happy to front any of their monthly meetings and talk to any of the issues that they have there, but more than happy to look at expanding that as well because, you know, I guess similar to you guys, that we understand the fact the more that we can keep people informed, the more that we can head issues off before they become a problem.
Thinking about front-footing it is the...
Yeah, so in terms of this process here, like I said at the start, we would be bringing the Gibston Community Association through the landfill to actually point out to them the works that will be happening, where they'll be happening. Weren't planning to, I guess, open that to the broader community. That was more going to be via the media side of explaining that to the Central Otago, I guess, commuting community, as well as the Queenstown Lakes community.
No further questions. All right. Thank you very much, ladies, and appreciate that. And good to hear the plan.
No worries.
And,
thank you, guys.
And the update. Thank you, Peter. All right, we'll move on through our agenda and then next on to the minutes of the 26th of June meeting and also the minutes of the 1st of August Extraordinary Council meeting. We can probably take them together. They have been circulated as part of your agenda. Councillor Hope, you're happy they're a true and accurate record.
Thank you.
Is there a second to Councillor Robertson? No discussion, I'll put it. All in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Carried. Thank you. The actions are listed there with an update for you. First couple in progress. There's been some responsibilities assigned for the next three, and the last one is complete. No questions there. Councillor Lawton?
Yeah, can I please have an update on the appointment of the representative to define the
Mr. Portakey and I have had a conversation very briefly with an aim to come together and have a meeting. Unfortunately, that hasn't been able to happen for reasons discussed earlier this morning. And so, I've just been waiting to see who we should work with, you know, whether that's going to be Mr. Portakey or not.
And as part of that discussion,
the Manawhaka Hono agreement?
Yeah, through the
Island
Aid process. Is that included in the discussion as to whether or not that's...
Yes. Absolutely. I think we do need to have a discussion that touches on that, and we have touched on that several times before. So I think, there's a view there to having an agreement. That, of course, is just within an RMA sense, because it is under the RMA and our partnership is broader than that, but yes, part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And just adding to that, we have had a request for a mana to mana meeting before the end of the triennium. It was hoped to tack it on to the end of our Te Rupatao and the mayoral forum next week, but that's not possible, so we'll be having that probably early October.
Okay.
And with the Runanga chairs. All right, no further questions. We'll move on to item 10 of the agenda and the chairpersons and chief executives' reports.